This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm PJ Thumb and I'm a historian from the University of Oxford. And this is the history of Singapore. Before today's episode, a small announcement. Season 1 will conclude with episode 49 at 3 p.m. on the 7th of October 2016. Immediately after episode 49, so around 3:30 p.m, I will be in the BFM studio for a live discussion. So if you have any questions, please listen in and you'll have the opportunity to call in or tweet your questions and I will try to answer them live on BFM 89.9 on Friday 7th of October at around 3:30 p.m. I look forward to hearing from you then. Episode 46, the 1964 political riots. By the time Malaysia was created in September 1963, there was an absence of trust and goodwill between politicians on both sides of the causeway. Before 1961, there had been some friendship. But from the time Singapore Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew started pursuing merger in 1961 to the actual achievement of merger in 1963, what friendship existed had fallen apart. The fights over the arrests of Singapore's political opposition, over the rights of Singaporeans in Malaysia and their citizenship, over the financial and economic arrangements, over the timing of merger, along with the petty insults to political maneuvering, all motivated by the structural, cultural, social and political differences in the two territories, destroyed any trust and goodwill by the time merger happened on 16 September 1963. This is not to say that Malaysia was doomed from the beginning. Things could have worked. Politicians on both sides wanted to make it work. But making Malaysia work in an environment with so many differences, so many different incentives, so many challenges would have required patience and tact and sacrifice and humility, empathy, compromise from both sides. Now, Lee Kuan Yew is a very smart man and a great politician, but patience, tact, sacrifice, humility, empathy, compromise, these are not characteristics that he possessed. So last week, I discussed the domestic consequences for the PAP's victory in the September 1963 elections. Thanks to the PAP's possibly illegal and definitely unfair tactics, they squeaked home with a narrow victory on 21st September, and they moved swiftly to consolidate power. The very next day, 22nd September, the PAP began proceedings to strip Tan Lak Sye of his citizenship for nothing more than having supported the Barisan Socialists at the elections. Further arrests and detentions without trial followed, including Operation Pecha, which saw 30 people, including almost the entire Central Committee of the Barisan-allied Singapore Association of Trade Unions, arrested, including three Barisan members of parliament, the party chairman S.T. Badi, Lo Miao Kung, and Lee Ti Tong. By the end of the month, the left-wing trade union movement was destroyed and the PAP's allied trade unions were unchallenged in Singapore. Finally, the PAP pushed a bill through parliament which gave them 12 of the 15 Singapore seats in the federal parliament, even though by the proportional representation formula, they should have had no more than 11. And the Barisan got the other three. The other important surprise of the 1963 elections was that the PAP won all three Malay-majority constituencies in Singapore. As I have repeatedly emphasized, there is very little evidence that Singaporeans have ever voted on communal lines, on ethnic lines. And Singapore UMNO's poor performance in the past few years, its own ferocious internal battles and splits, and its alliance with the politically bankrupt Singapore People's Alliance, all undoubtedly contributed to their losses. As a whole, the Singapore Alliance failed to win a single seat and was comprehensively rejected by Singapore voters. Having consolidated its grip domestically, then, the PAP began to dream of taking the party north of the causeway and challenging UMNO in the upcoming federal elections. This was, of course, a long-standing ambition of the PAP's, but its unexpected victory gave it the confidence to pursue this goal sooner rather than later. From UMNO's perspective, the loss in Singapore was a massive shock. They had never lost those three constituencies before and now had lost to a party they saw as a Chinese-dominated socialist party. Having personally campaigned in Singapore, the Tunku's personal prestige had taken a blow. And at rallies and meetings after the election, the Tunku condemned Malays who had not voted for UMNO as traitors. He promised that Singapore UMNO would henceforth be an integral part of national UMNO, that he would take a personal interest in Singapore party affairs. It was a pretty standard attempt to rally the party base, seek unity, and reaffirm the party's mission after a bad loss. But many within UMNO were much more emotional, and in particular, the man who would come to symbolise the face of UMNO extremism during this time, its chief publicity officer, Syed Jaafar Albar, who vowed to fix, that's a quote, fix Lee Kuan Yew at the proper time. Quote, "We are prepared to use both words and fists to teach him a lesson in democracy," unquote. He declared, perhaps not quite understanding what democracy is. At a rally in Singapore on 27 September, Syed Jaafar made another fiery speech, and he was joined by Singapore UMNO leaders who all made heated speeches. An effigy of Lee was burned in front of a screaming crowd. The Tunku, who was also present, asserted to the audience of UMNO members that Singapore was in the hands of the central government led by UMNO, not the PAP. The next day, in response at a PAP victory rally, Lee initially struck a conciliatory tone, saying they would work together with the central government. But he repeatedly reiterated, not just on this occasion, but at many others, that it would be, quote, cooperation on an equal basis, not that of master and servant, unquote. He warned Kuala Lumpur against thinking of doing anything stupid and that they should not believe they could, quote, keep Singapore down, unquote. He conjured up a vision of Kuala Lumpur taking over Singapore by force, said that the PAP was not afraid, quote, of what the central government can do to Singapore, unquote. He told KL to leave Singapore to, quote, resolve the problems which they could not understand, unquote. And he then shifted into attacking the Malayan Chinese Association and urging UMNO to work with the PAP. And this initial exchange between the two sides demonstrates the fundamental structural problem with politics in Malaysia. At the beginning, Malaysia had no national parties, only regional parties. The alliance was based out of the former federation, the PAP is a Singapore party, Sabah and Sarawak had their own parties. So think about the implications then. You have a country formed from four territories mashed together. Who speaks for the country as a whole? Who governs? Who protects the smaller or poorer parts from domination by the larger or richer parts? How do you stop the four parts from fighting with each other? The obvious immediate solution was to have all four territories represented in a national unity cabinet for the time being. But the deal behind merger was that Singapore's politics would be separate from the federation's. So national parties and hence national unity was explicitly not possible from the very beginning of Malaysia. So think about political power, about the incentives around it. In a democratic system, both UMNO and the PAP had to reflect the will of their voters. UMNO was the leader of the federal government. It was supposed to take care of the country as a whole. How could it do so unless it played a role in Singapore, the richest and largest state by population? The PAP was supposed to represent Singapore within Malaysia. How could it do so without playing a role in federal politics? The contradictions of the situation were obvious. Indeed, Lim Chin Siong had pointed it out in 1962. But they had been ignored in the rush to merger. And this contradiction would slowly play itself out over the next year and a half with disastrous consequences. Indeed, in some ways, it's still playing itself out today. So after this initial flurry of exchanges, things calmed down. Relations between Singapore and KL were generally peaceful. To combat Indonesia's propaganda campaign as part of Konfrontasi, from the 20th of January to the 26th of February 1964, Lee Kuan Yew went on a goodwill mission to Africa to convince African leaders that Malaysia was not a neo-colonial construct. And he was very successful. But while he was away, the PAP Central Executive Committee decided that the PAP would send a token force north of the border to contest Malaysia's 1964 federal elections. And this controversial move broke the peace. Lee had declared publicly on many occasions that the PAP would not contest the 1964 federal elections. So, what changed? Accounts disagree as to who made this decision to go north. Lee claims that the CEC made the decision and he reluctantly acceded to it on his return. But I think Lee had the final word for three reasons. First, before he left, Lee outlined the situation in a series of memoranda to the party's Publicity and Propaganda Coordinating Committee in October and November 1963, which made clear the inevitability of the PAP going north. If not in 1964, then definitely in the following election. But they would be much better set up for the following election if they contested the 1964 election. Second, as we've seen from previous episodes, Lee had this habit of creating political cover for himself through physically absenting himself during crucial moments, despite already having exerted influence on the decision. So this falls into a pattern of his behavior. And third, the idea that the PAP Central Executive Committee could make Lee Kuan Yew do something he didn't want to do is just silly. Nobody makes Lee Kuan Yew do something he doesn't want to do. Not in Singapore, not after 1963. So, given the PAP's control of Singapore and having totally wiped out the Singapore Alliance, the party felt confident. Their strategy was similar to that of 1955. They would just run a few token representatives to set themselves up for a stronger bid for power in the next election. And the breaking of the promise was justified by arguing that, well, the Tunku came down and campaigned in Singapore in September 1963. He broke the agreement first. But I don't think that's much of a reason. Singapore UMNO was running in the September 1963 election and the Tunku was the leader of UMNO. He was involved whether he liked it or not. Indeed, if you think about it, the whole point of merger was getting the Tunku to come and interfere in Singapore politics when he had not wanted to. In previous years, he came down often to speak and campaign on behalf of UMNO. And more significantly, in 1955, the Tunku and Syed Jaafar Albar came down to Singapore to campaign on behalf of a fledgling new party called the People's Action Party. So for the PAP to argue that the Tunku should not have come down to Singapore is rather hypocritical and ignores their own history. So should the Tunku have avoided campaigning for Singapore UMNO in September 1963? Yes, I think so. But equally, should the PAP have stayed out of federal elections in 1964 until it had built up some trust and also built up its strength in Malaysia? Yes. But in both cases, hindsight is 2020. So, on the 1st of March 1964, Toh Chin Chai, as PAP chairman, declared that the PAP, quote, should consider itself a national party, unquote, and announced that the party would play a, quote-unquote, token part in the April elections. Naturally, the alliance was not amused. Relations between Singapore and KL took a nosedive. In the election, the PAP took a careful line. They ran only 9 candidates. Their goal was to replace the MCA within the governing coalition, and so they carefully aimed only at MCA, avoiding any conflict with UMNO. And indeed, they called upon voters to support UMNO. To avoid taking any communal or ethnic line in their campaigning, the PAP took the tactic of presenting themselves as the defender and upholder of urban interests, based on their expertise in Singapore, not as a representative of Chinese interests. And they campaigned to massive crowds, outdrawing alliance rallies by a huge margin, scaring alliance politicians who feared that the PAP might actually win. But it didn't work. It didn't convince UMNO, and more importantly, it didn't convince voters. See, first, given UMNO's public and private commitment to the alliance, weakening the MCA would be weakening the alliance, which would be weakening UMNO. And the PAP's message was inconsistent. It told its supporters that in areas where the PAP was not running, they should vote for a pro-Malaysia party, apart from the MCA. So even within the cabinet, message discipline was sometimes lacking. On 15th of March, Rajaratnam said, quote, "We are not trying to supplant the MCA, nor do we want to align ourselves with UMNO," unquote. On the very same day, Lee Kuan Yew gave a speech in which he said, quote, "The Chinese leadership in the alliance, as represented by the MCA, is replaceable," unquote. Second, the PAP's attempt to avoid communal politics via its simplistic dichotomy of a rural-urban divide in Malaysia, in which it could represent the urban Malaysia, implied that that UMNO was representative of rural Malaysia, which was inaccurate. And even so, it often failed to avoid communal politics. For example, when Lee advised urban voters to vote for his party so that UMNO leaders would have to, quote, "adjust their social and economic policy to take into account the wishes of the people in the towns," unquote. So this implied, that Malays did not live in towns and that UMNO had neglected the welfare of non-Malays. But at other times, the PAP departed from their dichotomy to talk in terms which were far more sweeping. Like when Lee said at a rally in KL that when the people of Malaysia, quote, "demonstrated they were in favour of an honest government with a dynamic social and economic policy, then the winds of change will begin to sweep through Malaysia," unquote. Of course, the implication of that was that the alliance was not an honest government with an undynamic social and economic policy, and that the winds of change would sweep away UMNO and the alliance. So overall, no matter what the PAP intended, UMNO interpreted the PAP's calls for things like, and I'm quoting here, "a more egalitarian society, more equal opportunities, a more just and equal society." UMNO interpreted all these as attacks on Malay privileges, and you can see why. So in light of this, there was no way UMNO was going to consider dropping the MCA. The only way the PAP could succeed was to win convincingly, to knock out the MCA, thus building a national party and changing the political arithmetic of Malaysia. And they failed. Voters stuck with the party they knew instead of the unknown upstart. On polling day, 25th April 1964, UMNO won convincingly. The alliance won convincingly, 89 seats out of 104, which was a gain of 15 seats. The MCA, which the PAP had pronounced dead, won 27 seats, 9 more than the previous election. The PAP won only one in Bangsa, which was Malaysia's largest constituency, by just 808 votes. So the PAP did change the arithmetic in Malaysia, but in ways which made it worse for them. They destroyed any trust which had been building with the Tunku and the alliance leadership. Its attempt to displace the MCA had not only failed, but strengthened the MCA position. And most of all, I think the PAP leadership did not seem to recognize that the mere existence of an assertive or aggressive Chinese party was seen by the alliance and a substantial portion of their voters as itself a threat to Malaysia, to the entire political system, to Malaysian stability and peace and ethnic harmony. Lee Kuan Yew emerged from the election seen not just as an enemy of the alliance, but an enemy of Malays, and hence of Malaysia itself. Before the election, out of courtesy, the PAP had been seated as a crossbench party in the Dewan Rakyat, 5 on the government side, 6 on the opposition side. After the election, they emerged as the largest party outside of the alliance, but they were all seated on the opposition benches. Lee declined to be recognized as the leader of the opposition, but regardless, the PAP would be treated as such, the focal point of attack, the main enemy. And in a reversal of September 1963, April 1964 now emboldened the alliance. All bargains were off and it would plunge back into Singapore politics with renewed energy. And it would fight on the ground that it had mastered, communal politics. It would fight for the Malay vote. So, Sadly, the most significant outcome of the PAP's ill-fated decision to contest the 1964 federal election was to turn Singapore politics in a communal direction. And this would have tragic consequences. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm PJ Tham. If you've just joined us, welcome to this week's episode of The History of Singapore, the 1964 Political Riots. Despite the Alliance's sweeping election victory in April 1964, UMNO leaders could see the writing on the wall. If they did nothing and allowed the PAP to grow throughout Malaysia, it would lead ultimately to the PAP challenging the Alliance on a non-communal socialist platform. It would undermine the entire basis for the Alliance vote. They needed to push back, and the election victory gave them the confidence to take the fight to the PAP, to seek to recapture the Malay vote that it had recently lost in the September 1963 elections, and to confine the PAP to Singapore by forcing them to fight a rearguard action to maintain their hold on their home ground. Thus, immediately after the elections, UMNO began a campaign to undermine Malay support for the PAP in Singapore. A campaign of editorials and articles in Malay newspapers like Utusan Melayu, Utusan Zaman, and the UMNO newsletter, Merdeka, along with speeches by UMNO leaders and activists, accused the PAP of being anti-Malay. And it would be brutal, no holds barred. From the UMNO's perspective, Lee Kuan Yew had struck first, so they were just striking back. He had sold the Tunku on the idea of Singapore being full of Chinese chauvinism and communism, and then proved his point by stabbing the Tunku in the back, breaking his promise and taking the PAP north. To UMNO, the PAP's election rhetoric was barely disguised racialism, implying that the Malays were mainly rural and thus backward and poor, while the Chinese were urban and thus rich and cosmopolitan. If you've been listening to this series regularly, you'll understand why Lee was not seen as just another politician. Because he was not playing by the rules. Because he presented an attractive, alternative vision of Malaysia based on their proven track record of success in Singapore. Because he presented a very different idea of Malaysian identity. So Lee was not just challenging UMNO, he was challenging the entire framework of communal politics that had been established in Malaya since 1948. He was challenging UMNO's vision of Malayan identity, their right to define Malayan identity. He was challenging the position of the Malay elite and their conservative vision of Malaya. If Lee succeeded in winning, from the UMNO point of view, he was not just winning a change of government. He was utterly destroying their world. And that explains the depth of passion in their response. The PAP, of course, had a different view. They argued that the Tunku had come south first. They had taken a careful line that they were about urban development. They were only attacking the MCA. They were only attacking the people around the Tunku, not the Tunku himself. They were pro-Malaysia. Perhaps they believed their own rhetoric, which I'm probably rather naive. But when UMNO responded so violently, so virulently, it seemed to shock the PAP, who at this point still hoped to work with UMNO and displace the MCA. But, you know, in the end, none of this matters, all this why they did it. Because I think the biggest problem was really down to the lack of trust on both sides. There was no trust. So both sides interpreted the other's actions in the worst possible light. They assumed the worst, responded in the most hostile fashion, and things escalated accordingly. So the UMNO strategy in Singapore was to undercut the PAP's claim that they had achieved multiracial success in Singapore on the basis of non-communal socialist policies. And to a significant extent, they had a point. Then, as today, the Malay community was the poorest in Singapore. Unlike the rest of Malaysia, they had no special privileges apart from the field of education. Merger had created an expectation in the Malay community that the special privileges that Malays enjoyed elsewhere in Malaysia would be extended to them. But UMNO knew that the PAP could never concede special privileges to Singapore apart from education. It was not only against the PAP platform. it would not only undermine the PAP's distinctive selling point and turn it into just another ordinary political party, but it could possibly tear the party apart. And so UMNO and its allies aggressively seized upon every mistake, every slip-up, every little bit of discrimination, whether intentional or not, and held these up as examples of PAP misgovernance. They noted that the PAP was dominated by Chinese and Indian leaders, but where were the Malays? The PAP leadership only had a token representative, Minister for Social Affairs Othman Wok, who was branded a traitor. And in particular, the biggest issue they seized upon was the PAP's eviction of Malay kampongs for redevelopment. These were held up as discrimination and an attack on Malay rights, not just their property rights, but their rights as Bumiputra. The headline in the Utusan Melayu ran, quote, "Do not treat the sons of the soil as stepchildren," unquote. Again and again, its articles and editorials painted Singapore's Malays as, quote unquote, victims suffering from, quote unquote, pro-Chinese bias, victims of, quote unquote, PAP colonialism. And most of all, the line that they repeated the most often, they were, quote, stepchildren abused by their stepfather, unquote. Now, to be fair, these were the same tactics that the PAP had used against the Barisan Socialists. All the usual tactics, holding up straw men, twisting facts into half-truths, deliberate misinterpretation of events to portray them in as sinister a light as possible, and so on. But the PAP found themselves, for the first time since 59, in an environment in which they could not control the media. And so their propaganda advantage had dissipated. And again, to put it in context, this is politics. We see this in the USA, we see this in the UK, in Europe, we see this in our newspapers in Singapore and Malaysia today, whether it's the Utusan Malaysia or the Straits Times. Or just look at the things that the PAP said on the stump at the 2011 election. Same tactics. But these tactics keep getting used because, unfortunately, they work. And in 1964, discontent spread through the Malay community. And the situation was escalated at an UMNO meeting with the Malay community on the 12th of July. The keynote speaker, our friend Syed Jaafar Alba, who was now Secretary General of UMNO, launched into a blistering attack on Lee Kuan Yew. To shouts of "kill him" and "crush him" from the audience, Syed Jaafar accused Lee of inciting racial hatred, of being a traitor, a colonialist, evil, and most ironically, he accused Lee of being a communist. Yes, the shoe was now on the other foot. And although Syed Jaafar was careful to begin and end his speech with calls for harmony and peace, the speech whipped up the crowd into a murderous frenzy against Lee. Ali bin Haji Ahmad, the Assistant Secretary General of UMNO, accused the PAP of wanting to, quote, turn this country into an Israel where the Muslims are pressed down and suppressed, unquote. And this crossed the dangerous line because up to this point, the PAP had only been accused of discriminating against Malays. But now they were being accused of being anti-Muslim as well. And this attack would be followed upon after the meeting. Meanwhile, a few days later, representatives from 100 Malay associations met with Lee, but Lee held firm and refused to extend special concessions beyond the field of education. So it didn't really help his cause, and accusations of the PAP being anti-Malay and anti-Muslim grew in intensity. Emotions reached fever pitch on the 21st of July 1964, the Prophet Muhammad's birthday. On that day, during a parade to commemorate the birthday of the Prophet, fights broke out, leading to a full-scale riot which spread island-wide, festered for a week, and in which 22 people died. The whole island was placed under curfew. These riots were a huge shock. Singapore prided itself on its racial harmony and religious tolerance, and Singapore had never had a racial riot before, or since. But was this also a racial riot? These riots have since become part of the national narrative about the fragility of race relations in Singapore. But it's important to point out a few facts, which come from the official government report, the This is the title, Memorandum Submitted by the Government of Singapore to the Commission of Inquiry into the Disturbances in Singapore in 1964. And these drew from eyewitness and official police reports. So make of it what you will in that context. First, what is clear is the riots did not happen in Geylang. They happened on Kallang Road, near the junction with Kampong Supu, which was, perhaps not coincidentally, a hotbed of anger and discontent against the government over the forced evictions. Second, eyewitness accounts suggest that much of the initial violence was, if not premeditated, at least deliberate. Othman Wok, for example, noted a group of Malay youths on Victoria Street who shouted, quote, "Hidup China, mati Melayu," as the PAP contingent marched past them, which is a very strange thing for a group of Malay youths to shout. Mohammad Ghazali, political liaison secretary at the Ministry of Culture, witnessed a group of Malays running around shouting that a Malay was being attacked by Chinese policemen, but no eyewitness account exists of a Chinese policeman attacking a Malay at this point in time. Members of the PAP contingent also recalled that the outbreaks of violence seem oddly coordinated. Othman Wok recalls the first attack coming from the Pan-Malay Union contingent behind them on a Chinese Federal Reserve Unit policeman. Then a second assault on other Chinese coming immediately from the UMNO contingent ahead of them. And so he believes it was a deliberate attempt between all these, the shouting, the attacks. It was a deliberate attempt to blame the PAP contingent for violence. Official investigations by Special Branch and by the police corroborated this, concluding that the initial violence was started by a group of Malays attacking the Chinese policemen, then proceeding onwards to further violence down Kallang Road. Despite all the eyewitness accounts, no one was able to identify any of the initial attackers, suggesting that they were not locals. Third, what all sides agreed was that the riots were not caused primarily by racial antagonism, but by the political environment and the inflammatory racial rhetoric. UMNO leaders blamed Lee Kuan Yew. PAP leaders and the British blamed UMNO leaders, particularly Syed Jaafar Albert. So the mystery about the riots was not really what exactly happened on Kallang Road that day. We actually have lots of eyewitness accounts and police reports, although of course they come from the official Singapore government report, so we have to keep that in mind. However, I think we can be reasonably confident how it started. Events do suggest some sort of deliberate, maybe even premeditated assault. What will be always shrouded in controversy is why it started. Was it deliberately instigated to discredit the PAP? Or was it a group of youths who had been antagonized by the inflammatory rhetoric of the past few months? Under pressure from Singapore, an official commission of inquiry was eventually convened in KL in March 1965, but it was held in secret and its findings remain classified to this day. But the more important thing is, all the possible explanations from the riot agree that it was created by the political environment. Thus, to call the riot a race riot is to neglect the fact that the riot would never have happened if not for the circumstances surrounding it, especially the racialized campaign that UMNO embarked upon, and in particular the calls to violence from Syed Jaafar Albar and his UMNO colleagues. But even more broadly, if you think over the course of the last 10 or so episodes of this show, that the circumstances would not have existed if Lee Kuan Yew had not initiated merger explicitly on a racialized basis, selling merger as a way to suppress Singapore's Chinese, creating a constitutional structure designed to suppress Singapore, and then refusing to abide by the bargain by going north and campaigning on implicitly racial terms. In September 1964, a further set of riots broke out. These were blamed on instigation by Indonesian agents as part of Konfrontasi. But regardless of who started those riots, the fundamental truth of the matter is that, regardless of the immediate circumstances, the riots would not have happened without the inflamed situation created by the attempts on both sides within Malaysia to resolve the fundamental contradiction caused by Malaysia's artificial political divide, which was itself the result of the rush to merger because of selfish politicians on both sides of the causeway. The riots happened because of selfish politicians who manipulated the two territories for political and economic power, and they sacrificed the lives and futures of people in Singapore to get it. And so to remind us of this, I suggest that we start with something very simple. It starts by not calling the 1964 riots race riots, but political riots. The 1964 political riots. Let us never forget why 22 of our countrymen died. They died for selfish political gain. Next week, we continue the story of Malaysia with the fallout from the violence and how it permanently changed the relationship of the PAP to UMNO. Join us then. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week. This has been the History of Singapore, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.